Hi, I'm Jay Donskani, founder and editor of All Over Cricket and host of the All Over Cricket podcast. For episode 7, I'm joined by Fidel Fernando, who, as most of you know, is the Sri Lanka correspondent for ESPN Crick Info and one of the world's most prominent cricket writers. He's also the author of a travel book called Upon a Sleepless Isle, which we'll link to in the show notes. Fidel and I examine the issues with how cricket is run in the island nation and how this spills over into on-field performance. We also discuss the prospects of the men's team in the ongoing Super League and their chances at the T20 World Cup before we end with a takedown of the SLC's apathy towards the women's game. You can follow Fidel on Twitter at AFidelF. And for more global cricket content, you can follow us on Twitter and Facebook at All Over Crick. Welcome to episode 7 of the All Over Cricket podcast. I'm your host, Jay Donskani, and today we have a really special guest, Crick Info's very own Fidel Fernando. Fidel, how's it going?
Jay, pleasure to be here with you.
Yeah, absolutely, Fidel. So I got to be honest, we're approaching the double figure mark for number of episodes, but I've never been more confused about where to start a podcast. But I guess it makes most sense to start with, I guess, the most recent of many issues or scandals in Sri Lankan cricket. Let's talk about the bio bubble breach. I'm blanking on this. Kushal Mendes
and Nirosh and Dequella. Yeah.
Exactly. Just walk us through that and your thoughts on that.
The bubble popping trio. It's hard to wrap your mind around because it's so stupid. You know, like it's so daft what these players did. I think that they probably just, you know, felt like they needed to go out. It's not as if they were shut in the entire time that they were in the UK, by the way. When they were in Cardiff, like I think the bio bubble kind of arrangements changed or the requirements changed from venue to venue. So when they were in Cardiff, they were allowed to go out for a coffee within 1 kilometer of the hotel. So it wasn't as if, like, you know, they were in this extremely lockdown kind of curfew environment, right? Which, by the way, I mean, Sri Lanka itself had been in curfew, much stricter curfew than these players had been. So Sri Lankans kind of were living in much stricter conditions for a long time over the last couple of months than these players had been. So it makes it even harder to understand why they did this, because they know by now, you know, no one's forcing them to go on tours. If they're sick of the bio bubble, if there's kind of bubble fatigue, they're allowed to opt out for personal reasons. I don't think anyone would have made much of that or would have understood that, but they didn't. They decided to go on the tour, and yet they went out when they'd specifically been told, and Durham's kind of numbers had been quite high as well. So Durham's, where they went out, the numbers had been kind of skyrocketing over the previous few days. So they'd been told specifically, don't go to the city center. And they went out, I don't think they'd been out for that long. You know, it's not like they were out all night partying. They kind of went out, had something to eat, it looks like.
Got something to smoke as well.
Yeah, had a smoke, it looks like. All of which are fine. You know, I've seen like a lot will be made of the fact that, you know, Kusal Mendes was kind of fidgeting with a packet of cigarettes. But I've seen elite international players on their days off, even during matches, man, like this will go up the stairs in between the dressing rooms and have a smoke. Yeah. You know, it's not that unusual, and it's not like, you know, we don't need to get moralistic about it. But we do need to be like, look, there are hundreds of thousands of dollars being spent for these bio bubbles to exist, for us to be able to watch, for them to be able to play, and for us to be able to watch cricket. All of these things are in place to protect everyone. And what they did was really responsible, is because if these videos had not emerged on social media, then the team doctors wouldn't have known that these guys had gone out. They could have gone out, you know, caught, you know, possibly been infected by, you know, with COVID, come back and, you know, possibly and conceivably spread it throughout the rest of the team who they were, you know, bio-bubbling with. I think those things make it kind of unforgivable. What I'm hearing now, though, is that, you know, is that the board is going to be extremely harsh on them. And I spoke to a couple of the coaches, and they are not expecting these players to be available for the T20 World Cup later this year. I think that's the kind of suspension the board is looking at, which seems really tough. Like, that seems overly harsh to me. It's just the board kind of like coming down on like a ton of bricks on players, like flexing their power, for flexing their power's sake. You know, it's not, that's not commensurate with the crime that was committed, right? Yes, they went out, suspend them for several games. You know, I think that like a decent suspension is warranted. A months long suspension, 6 months long suspension, that's a little bit going, you know, going over the top. And kind of also speaks to the breakdown relationship between the board and the players, which has been there for a long time. And also speaks to the incredibly kind of patronizing way in which the board views its players, which has also been paid out in the recent contracts kind of standoff, none of which is conducive to a working, healthy, productive professional relationship, which is what these groups in an ideal world should have. So I, you know, while I'm, you know, still aghast at the fact that these players did this, I will always be more aghast at the board's responses to this and the very kind of very narrow ways in which they see this. They see it, the whole of Sri Lanka was kind of outraged at when this happened, and social media kind of people were very, very upset that the players had been so irresponsible. But at the same time, you know, the board does worse things on a monthly, weekly basis, right? They act more responsibly frequently. So the people who are supposed to be disciplining them are in no way have kind of any kind of moral right to do that, given their own performance and their own jobs over the last, you know, 7 or 8 years. So that's kind of in kind of microcosm, that's a lot of the problems in I think we touched on a lot of problems in Sri Lankan cricket just talking about this one breach.
Absolutely, it's a good thing you bring that up, actually. As we all know, there's a big mixture of politics and cricket, and I guess that I read your article on Crick Info, which I'll link in the show notes. There's a big crossover between politics and cricket, and it shows up in the way that the sport is administered at the elite levels and the pathway levels, especially with the domestic system. I think I read in your article that there are 24 teams, so 264 men's cricketers. Can you just talk to us through that? And I know it's a loaded question, but you know, the timeline of all these proposed revamps to the provincial structure.
Yeah. Okay, so the we're kind of very quickly getting to the heart of the problem in Sri Lankan cricket. If we start talking about the 24 teams, and I'll tell you why there are 24 teams, right? So Sri Lanka cricket's constitution was written, I think, in the early 90s, possibly earlier, when there were quite a lot of clubs and kind of district provincial bodies. And Sri Lanka was not, you know, certainly before the 96 World Cup was won, right? This was not a team that was kind of performing at the elite level the way we were kind of used to them performing between, say, 96 to 2016, where they were kind of consistently one of the best teams in the world. This was, the constitution was drawn up long before that. And where, say, a New Zealand cricket has 7 or 8 votes to elect its board, Sri Lankan cricket has 145, if I remember correctly. It's in the 140s, right? So who are the people that vote in an SLC election, right? It's district bodies, provincial bodies, and all of these clubs, right? Clubs, many of which are completely defunct now, right? There are clubs that have not been operational in any form for 15, 20, 30 years, right? Who have a vote in the SLC election. So there is someone, the only reason that club even exists kind of legally is so that they can have a vote at the SLC election. So someone you know, say representing, let's say, I think there's a club called like Kolupitiya Recreational Sports Club, which does not exist. Like, you know, you can't, you look all over that part of town in Colombo, you'll never find the place, right? Because it doesn't exist. But at some point, it probably did, and they used to maybe hire a ground somewhere and play a few matches. But someone, some kind of vestigial member of that club still has a vote in this election. And the only reason they keep the club going is so that they can vote in the election. And the way the SLC officials get those votes is that they promise them something. They'll be like, we'll throw you a job at the board. We'll give you X benefit, you know, some benefit. There's lots of broadcast money, ICC money coming into the board. Obviously, they have funds to, they're not a wealthy board by any means, but they do have funds to kind of give to members. And so that's how these elections are won. No one is voting for these board members based on their performance as board members. They're voting for them based on how much they can personally get out of voting for these board members. So this is a problem, and this is how you can get 24 clubs, is because 24 first class teams, because clubs obviously like when their team is playing first class cricket. They get more money that way. They get more, many of their cricketers can claim to be first class cricketers, and those cricketers can then pursue kind of job opportunities overseas and playing for clubs. There's kind of a certain level of prestige associated with playing first class cricket. So when you promise the clubs, look, we're going to expand the first class competition and your club could be a first class club by next year, obviously they love it, right? There's more money coming into the club. And so you've got this hugely bloated system. And now I will break the first class system down. There's the first tier is 14 teams, and second tier is 10 teams. So it's not as if all 24 play in the same league, but then you do get, you know, former international players playing in the second tier, which wouldn't happen, say, if you only had six first-class teams in the country. Everybody who's played for Sri Lanka or is in contention for Sri Lanka selection would be kind of condensed in that top six teams. Whereas in this current system, there are, you know, players even in the bottom tier, in tier B, who are, you know, very good players who have at some point been in contention for Sri Lanka or had played one or two ODIs for Sri Lanka. You get those kinds of players playing in tier B. So the talent is very, very widespread, diluted. And if you're a good player coming through, you know, if you're a good player coming through, you're a good top order batsman, you can just, the opposition team probably has like two good bowlers, right?
Yeah.
So all you do is you just play out the opening overs, play out the overs from those two overs, and absolutely go to town on everybody else.
There's no bridge, right? There's no bridge between domestic and international level.
Absolutely. And you can never do that at international level because everybody at international level is a very good player. You know, an attack doesn't have those kinds of weak links, and you don't develop your game. You don't develop a toughness. You don't develop that mental toughness. You don't necessarily develop a defensive part of your game where you're defending for long periods of time. You don't develop that. Your techniques are, and then the coaching talent is also spread across these 24 teams. Everything is diluted, you know. So I think, you know, people like Kumar and Mahela talk about, even in their day, you know, domestic cricket was really, you know, Sri Lanka had only been a first-class cricket-playing country since 88. And these guys came in through a very, very green first-class system in the 90s. And they'll say, you know, the system we came through was so much better for you. It prepared us so much better for international cricket than the current system. And that is shocking, you know, that there can have been that kind of regression in 20, 25 years. Particularly when you think about, you know, it's not like Sri Lanka's first-class system was amazing to begin with. You know, yeah. It's not like it was ever a world-class first-class cricket system. But people just got really complacent, and the board became more and more self-serving and incapable of kind of seeing beyond its own, benefits to themselves and their own members. It's very hard to find a conglomeration of people that are both as incompetent and as powerful in Sri Lanka as the Sri Lankan cricket board.
Yeah, no, Absolutely. And I mean, anyone who's read any of your stuff on Crick Info, including your latest, I guess, takedown of everything that's wrong with Sri Lankan cricket will know how strongly you feel about this. I'm also interested to know, you know, like I said, just, I guess, the timeline of this whole shakeup of, you know, the provincial system, because a shakeup has been proposed quite a few times in the past, hasn't it? It's never materialized, has it?
Yeah, I mean, the thing is, there is no real political will to really bring that change. You know, reforming the domestic cricket system is not sexy, right? There are no sexy headlines to be gained out of it. You know, it's not like I was just writing a story on New Zealand, for example, right? And on New Zealand's rise in the last 10 years. And a big part of their story is the fact that they kind of went back, they relayed a lot of their pitches, they put a better high performance system in place. They kind of sharpened their, they tried to kind of hire people that, you know, had skin in the game in terms of like really wanting to work for New Zealand cricket rather than people who were kind of using New Zealand cricket as a stepping stone to another job. You know, they did all of these kind of very solid management and kind of grassroots decisions. And I was writing the story, but by far the more interesting part of the story was kind of this meeting that McCullum and Hessen and Mike Sandel had in Cape Town, where they'd kind of decided to change the identity of New Zealand. Now, that is a huge part of how the change took place. But there's also this other aspect of it, which, you know, even in my story, I didn't pay that much attention to, because it's not that interesting. You know, it's like someone did their job. You know, it's very procedural, you know. And I can see why you would come in and look at reforming first class cricket as not an interesting, particularly when it's not going to get you votes, or it's going to make the clubs very angry at you, and you're not going to get another term in this very, very cushy Sri Lankan cricket job, right? High paying Sri Lanka cricket job. So there's no political will to do that. What there is political will is to do is change the captains. We've had, I don't know how many captains. It's like everybody in the team has been a captain over the last, you know, everybody from Chamara Kapugethera to Malinga to Dinesh Chandimal to Tisara Pereira to now Dasan Shanaka, like Kusal Pereira, Angelo Matthews in like two or three stints. Everybody's had a turn of being, you know, one day captain, for example.
You missed out like 15 names there.
Yeah, that's not even half the list. It's that there is a sexy kind of, oh, like, oh, new captain comes in, offers, you know, to play fearlessly, offers to bring a new brand of cricket. And then when Sri Lanka continue to lose, because of course they do, because the players that are playing in the team aren't very good, you know. A captain can't make a player that's averaging 25 a 40 plus average player in one day cricket. You know, that's not in the captain's capacity to do that. And of course the board then goes out and blames the players, jumps on things like, you know, discipline, like the bubble popping, and absolutely goes to town on them. Former players come out and say, you know, it's due to lack of discipline, it's due to lack of like pride in playing for country. No, none of that is the thing. So that's where you create like the political will. It's to change captains. And to change coaches. So we've had the last two coaches, or last three coaches. No, last two coaches. Graham Ford was kind of elbowed out of his job before Marvin Athapattu first was kind of asked to leave before his contract was up. Graham Ford was elbowed out of his job before his contract was up. Chandik Hathersinger was sacked before his contract was up. Now Mickey Arthur, there's kind of whispers that the board's really not happy with what he's doing and whether they can get rid of him early. So those are the kinds of changes, that the top-down changes that SLC kind of drum up media support for. They can like very, very, and people eat it up too, you know. People who followed cricket for a long time will start criticizing the coaches, will start like criticizing the players and what they do on Instagram. Like, none of that to me is relevant, you know. This is, I don't care. You can post whatever you want on your Instagram. If when you get on the field, you score runs and take wickets and take catches, you know, that's all that, that should be, that we should care about. And, but instead, you know, it's just become like commonplace to question things like commitment, discipline, fitness, even though, you know, even for players who are passing their fitness tests, you know, mental aptitude, all of these things, are they more interested in having a social media lifestyle than being an international cricketer? Like, maybe they are, but if they're interested enough to be, if they're good enough at international cricket, I don't care what, you know, whether they care about, you know, whether they care more about Instagram or not. It's just not interesting to me. But I guess, like, yeah, that's essentially how it goes. And that's why, even though there have been attempts to reform, I think in 2014, 2015, Mahela came up with this kind of cluster idea where you start a provincial tournament and you have the clubs kind of clubs clustered around various provinces supporting the provincial structure. But as soon as a new board came in, they just got rid of it because there was no, there's no kind of political reason to pursue that and to put that into action.
That's really disappointing, honestly. Like, I'm just thinking about this. It's actually a miracle when you think about just some of the fast bowlers coming through the system. It's amazing that you have the likes of Dushmanta Chamira, Kasun Rajatha, Vishwa Fernando winning test matches overseas. But this is happening not because of the system. This is happening despite the system. And
yeah,
just, you know, just thinking back to 96, like you said, if the system was on Sri Lankan cricket side and if there was political will and we had a more concentrated talent pool at a provincial level, I feel like Sri Lanka would once again, you know, be competing, be genuine contenders at global tournaments. But right now you actually have a situation, and I guess we're taking a bit of a segue here. You have a situation where Sri Lanka are in real trouble of not getting an automatic berth to the next 50 over men's World Cup. There's a real chance that they finish outside of the top eight in the Cricket World Cup Super League.
Yeah.
So I guess my question, before I just keep rambling, my question is, do you see lower ranked full members, perhaps even associate nations, in maybe 15, 20 years from now, racing ahead of Sri Lankan cricket?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, that's very much a possibility. I can think of Ireland. Afghanistan's home situation is unfortunately not, you know, super conducive to, I guess, tapping all of the talent in their country. But if they can kind of get that under control, and if things go well for them, and we all hope it does, then they could very much build a very strong team. You know, they could leapfrog Sri Lanka easily. The one thing that Sri Lanka cricket and Sri Lanka has got going for it is that cricket is still by far the top sport in the country, you know, by a huge distance. You know, there's like cricket, daylight, more daylight, and then probably rugby, if you're thinking or maybe track and field if you're thinking about domestic sport. So there are, you know, when you walk around, you still see kids playing cricket. You know, maybe you see fewer than you might have 10 years ago. It's still the sport that everybody plays on the street. And so you will continue to produce raw talents. It's that these raw talents do not get polished at the top level, right? And they're not. And also the raw talents often aren't, the talent isn't harnessed or funneled in the right direction. Often you lose young, promising cricketers to, you know, corporate jobs or whatever, because the pay in domestic cricket is so low. You know, when you have to pay 264 players in a per week, you're obviously not going to be paying them that much. So so there's that issue as well. I very much see, you know, Nepal could rise up and get beyond Sri Lanka. And if you're talking 15, 20 years time, all of these things can, you know, Ireland, Afghanistan, Nepal, Bangladesh, I would argue in limited overs cricket has already maybe like pulled ahead of Sri Lanka right now. In Test cricket is the only kind of place where there's at least like some semblance of like a decent performance at the moment. But even that can't be taken for granted. You know, there's Sri Lanka kind of rode on some great players, you know, when Rangan Herath was still winning the number one match winner in the team until he retired. And it's hard to see Sri Lanka kind of sustaining unless there are some major changes. And the changes won't bring victories overnight, just as it has taken a long time for the rot in Sri Lanka's domestic cricket to show itself and to kind of translate into the top team's decline. It's going to take a long time to build it back up again, because I think once you start doing making grassroots changes, the fruits of that will not be born for 5-10 years. So it's a long grind. I think unless Sri Lanka make those changes, 15-20 years, I shudder to think at the place Sri Lanka cricket could be.
I'm glad you bring up something like the Lanka Premier League, which has been postponed. How important would it have been, and what kind of impact would the Lanka Premier League have had on the preparation of Sri Lanka's players? But also, part two of the question, can it make up for the lack of a provincial structure in any way?
I mean, in T20 cricket, I think the LPL is probably going to be your pinnacle tournament rather than the provincial one, because if they execute it well, if they continue to attract more and more foreign talent and they kind of get the investment that they are hoping for, but they haven't quite nailed it. You know, the second edition of the tournament is not, although the first one was kind of a qualified success. The second one is not for sure going to happen. They're having issues where they've already nixed two of the teams, and the third one, Jaffna Stallions, who kind of generated the most publicity in the first event, there are some issues with them, and kind of they're considering getting rid of that team, which would be a huge blow, because that was really the team, and them winning it was the story of that first tournament. So it's still like very fragile, that tournament. We're not sure if it is going to happen. But if they manage to get it going, like, you know, in an ideal world, that would be the thing that feeds into Sri Lanka's T20 talent. It could be like a CPL where local cricketers really hone their T20 game. And that, I think, would be, rather than having a provincial tournament, I think, is more important for one day and test cricket. Whereas I think in T20s, the LPL is where a lot of good T20 kind of honing can happen, as long as it's a long enough tournament. You know, it needs to be at least 3 weeks long, and each team needs to play at least, you know, 7 or 8 games.
Yep.
Because otherwise, if the tournament is too short, then there's not much of a point. I guess the challenge for Sri Lanka cricket is going to be to sustain it, given the increasingly packed international schedule and the challenges in attracting foreign talent. And you know, finding the reason why it was postponed from July, August, by the way, is because the Kashmir T20 League was coming up, and India and Bangladesh seem to be playing a series. So Bangladesh cricketers were going to be out of the equation. Australian cricketers anyway would have been tough for the league to attract. So those are the reasons. We'll see, I guess. Like, that's the one thing that SLC have done over the last couple of years that you can say wasn't a train wreck. I think still the jury's out. I hope it goes well. And the last year definitely was fun to watch. It was a fun tournament.
Yeah, no doubt. I actually want to go back to our discussion about, you know, lower ranked full members potentially racing ahead and leapfrogging Sri Lanka. And you know, you mentioned Afghanistan as well, a lot of problems at home, but when you compare them to Sri Lanka, I feel like Afghanistan, their players, a lot of their players are still getting picked up in overseas T20 leagues. And it's almost like the West Indies, like that, when they had all that turmoil with the board before Ricky Skerritt, at least you had around a dozen or even more, you know, T20 freelancers plying their trade and honing their skills around the world. And you're kind of seeing that with Afghanistan on a smaller scale. But I'm trying to think about, you know, Sri Lanka's T20 stars. Okay, there's Wanindu Hasaranga, but that's it. I mean, I think Matthews got picked up in the 100 as a replacement. I think earlier today that was reported. So you've got Hasaranga, you've got Matthews, maybe Chamira, but that's it, right?
Yeah. I mean, even Chamira, he's had a lot of injury issues. I'm a fan of Chamira, but his performance has been kind of, he hasn't been performing in white ball cricket for that long. You know, it's just been recent that he's had a little bit of rhythm going. It's not like he's been one of those who's probably been sustained it for a little bit longer. He's probably been performing for a couple of years now. There's no real stars. I mean, there's no one who consistently performs well enough, is injury free for long enough to warrant a place. Cicero Pereira, who has now retired, by the way, from international career, he would have probably been part of Sri Lanka's plans for the World T20, but he wasn't, or T20 World Cup, but he wasn't interested in sticking around because he kind of felt slighted by the selectors. So Isuru Udana still gets a couple of gigs every now and then, gets the Ram Slam, but yeah, overall Afghanistan have more cricketers who get jobs overseas. Part of the reason is also Sri Lanka plays a lot more international cricket still than Afghanistan, so they have international commitments which prevent a lot of Sri Lankan players from taking up these gigs, so that's part of the equation. But there's no one you look through that 11 and think an IPL team has to pick this guy up next year, you know, which virtually for every other top, you know, full member team, you can go down and be like, this guy or these two or three players, I would walk into any T20 league in the world. There's definitely not that. You don't get the sense that there are three players in the Sri Lankan roster who demand places in T20 leagues.
Yeah, absolutely. I think you hit the nail on the head there. And with just an eye on time, you know, all over cricket, we're big on being global and gender inclusive. And I suppose the fact that we haven't spoken about this yet is due to the fact that the Sri Lankan women are just not playing at all. There barely seems to be any murmur of any tour being organized, any sort of cricket being organized. You know, just we were talking about this off camera a little bit as well. Can you just tell us a little bit more about Sri Lankan cricket's apathy towards women's cricket?
Yeah, I mean, again, it's one of those things that it's not a popular thing. It's not something that will win the board a lot of cred, you know, growing women's cricket, investing in women's cricket, making sure that more schools are playing girls cricket, you know, more girls have the option of taking up cricket at a young age. None of these things are, they're very kind of common sense, good, sensible routes to go down, but none of them will generate sexy headlines for them, which I think is that's what drives Sri Lankan cricket or the officials that we have there now, is that they want this kind of like great publicity. They don't want to get stuck in and do the work that requires that would help cricket grow incrementally. They want to make the big plays, you know, so their focus is almost solely on the spotlight is almost solely on the national men's team, because that is the team that generates, you know, media coverage. And the women's team, I mean, we have a super, it's so sad because we have a superstar in Chamri Atapattu, someone who would probably walk into any team in the world. I know women's cricket has a lot of great openers, but, you know, she's very high up there. And despite the fact that she fights against this very this system that does not really support her, doesn't give the facilities, coaching, and kind of infrastructure that she needs to get the most out of her talent. She kind of runs this lone wolf campaign, you know, to drag the women's team kind of up by its bootstraps. And often we see her making half centuries, making hundreds, and the team is still losing despite that. You know, all she does is try and kind of stir her teammates up. But the rest of the team, I mean, it's not necessarily their fault either. They're still stuck in a system that doesn't really believe in them, and a system that's not really geared towards finding better women's talent, you know, that's not, or developing the talent that they have. So it's not as if I blame the players here at all. And this is, I mean, the last time they played a match was in March in 2020, which was the Women's T20 World Cup in Australia. There were a couple of tours, I think a Bangladesh women's tour and an India women's tour that they should have been on that were scheduled for the time in between, but the board obviously wasn't willing to spend on the bio bubble procedures to make those tours happen. Obviously, the broadcast value of those tours is very, very minimal. So it, you know, the board was much more interested in spending in other areas than in spending on women's cricket. And for that reason, it's been ignored, and they've just been sitting dormant. And someone like Chamari, who's at the peak of her powers and should be at a time in her career where which is the most productive for her, she's essentially had a year or a couple of years taken out of her prime playing years by COVID, and because the board was uninterested in giving her matches to play. You know, it's a bit like, I think, Aravinda De Silva in the late 80s, early 90s, went through the same thing when Sri Lanka didn't play for a couple of years because of the war. And it's a very similar situation, except there's no war going on. It's just general incompetence and apathy. So, it's very sad to see that. The board does, I mean, there have been some improvements in terms of, like, there are more district coaches, there are more more talent searches in kind of provincial areas. But these are, you know, it's very, very, it's a very ad hoc system. You know, there's no kind of like pathway for if you're a talented, young woman or a girl, you know, playing cricket or playing another sport, and you want to get into the team and you say live outside of Colombo, the way to get into the team, it's very, very difficult, and the chances that you're going to be overlooked, that your talent is not going to be tapped by the system, are very high. And the board could be doing so much more in setting up academies around the country and setting up kind of especially making sure that schools cricket is strong for young girls, that more and more schools begin playing cricket, and the board can kind of really get around those schools and push the Ministry of Education, which kind of administers schools cricket, to provide better facilities, to provide better infrastructure, to run centralized camps so that, you know, the best, you know, women's or best young girls from around the country can come in at under 16 level, at under 19 level, play camps and take part in coaching camps in Colombo for a few weeks. None of that is really happening. There's no plan. There's no cohesive plan to develop women's cricket. And sadly, you see that in the performance of the top team, because Chamari Athapattu aside, there's not really been anybody who you can kind of point to and say, you know, they're going to have a really consistent, good career. You haven't seen that kind of consistency from anybody else.
Yeah. I mean, I guess one other name I'd throw in there is Shashi Kalashi Rewardene, but I mean, she has retired now, so
yeah, exactly.
It's so frustrating. I'm just, you know, trying to do the math on this one, but I'm pretty sure that amongst the 15 top ranked women's teams, let's just say in the T20I rankings, Sri Lanka is the only one to not play any cricket since the World Cup. You know, you have Ireland and Scotland organizing games. You have Germany organizing games as well. And there just seems to be no, like you said, it's just not a sexy issue. It's just not a cool thing to care about, and it's showing up in the results as well. You had Thailand, you know, beat them a couple of years ago, I believe in perhaps 2018. And absolutely no disrespect to Thailand. They probably would have beaten Pakistan, you know, had rain not intervened in March last year. But at the end of the day, you have associate nation countries who have realized that, okay, you know what? There's a real opportunity here in women's cricket. Let's work towards professionalization. You have Brazil who've professionalized women's cricket. They've got professional contracts. Malaysia, quite recently, actually, they've introduced, I believe, 15 or 16 professional contracts. So you have, and even Nepal, a big disparity between what the men and women are getting paid. But at the end of the day, I don't want to say they're necessarily leaving money on the table, but they're leaving results on the table. And there's so much, it seems like just such an obvious thing to do. If you want to be good, you have to play. You have to organize some sort of cricket. You need some sort of pathway. You need some sort of representation on the board as well, perhaps even a separate women's wing. And you just don't see that will. You don't see that concern. And there's no surprise that you don't see the results either.
Yeah, absolutely. It's almost criminal negligence, you know. It's not, for a team to get better, they have to play. And, you know, Sri Lanka's women's, I think they've won one match in the last 2 or 3 years in any format. And they're certainly not getting better at not playing anyone, you know, while other teams are playing and getting better. So once again, like say the women go out and have like a bad tournament, get beaten by an associate team, it's the same dance, you know, the players are going to get blamed. They're going to get blamed for not caring enough or whatever. The board certainly isn't going to take any responsibility for giving them, you know, zero conditions to thrive. That tends to be the pattern, and it's hard to kind of watch it happen over and over again, and see players who are, you know, very committed to what they do be treated with such disdain almost. If you can't have, say, a team like India come and play, if you're gonna cancel that tour, then what cricket are you gonna play? You know, like India, one of the best teams in the world, clearly, and not necessarily a tour that's going to cost Sri Lanka a lot of money, because, you know, they for them to just come hop over and play one series, it's just like if you're going to cancel that series, then you have no interest in playing cricket.
Yeah, Fidel, I got to say, you know, we recorded a couple episodes so far. This is by far the most grim episode of the All Over Cricket podcast.
People are crying right now. People are in the fetal position right now, being like, this is not what I wanted to hear on my way to work today.
No, but seriously, there's always some sort of silver lining, and man, it's a total mess. Like I've said, you know, I'll definitely link that piece you wrote for Crick Info in the show notes. With an eye on time, you know, I think, you know, let's wrap things up. To first of all, Fidel, thank you so much for coming on the podcast. This has been a great chat. It's been an angry chat at times, but it's been so illuminating. And you know, just to close things out, please, you know, just if we want to find you on social media, you know, how do we do it? If we want more of Fidel Fernando, how do we get more of you?
Yeah, there's I'm on Twitter mainly at afidelf. So you can find me pretty easily there. Obviously, all my articles on Crick Info as well. I also have, if you're interested in kind of reading travel book on Sri Lanka, I'm the author of a travel book called Upon a Sleepless Isle. So if you want to read more of my writing that's not about cricket, there's that as well.
Brilliant. Well, Fidel, thank you so much for coming on, and let's certainly stay in touch, and hopefully we bump into each other in a press box or something, not to, you know,
and have more pleasant conversations than this one.
Yeah, no doubt. Thank you so much for coming on, man.
Thank you for listening. A reminder that you can follow Fidel on Twitter at AFidelF. You can find us on Twitter and Facebook at All Over Crick. All Over Cricket is a multimedia publication featuring articles and podcasts from contributors spread across the world. We provide fans with original and engaging content that reflects the truly global and gender-inclusive sport that we believe cricket should be. If you liked this podcast, please share it and tell your friends about All Over Cricket.